Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who expresses concern about America's military culture, which led to the firing of General Stanley McChrystal and President Obama's uncertain strategy in Afghanistan. Israeli activist Ofer Naiman, who talks about his group, Boycott From Within, who is supporting the International Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign, whose goal is to force Israel to withdraw from Palestinian land. And Haley Hathaway, with the Jubilee USA Network, who discusses the failure of G20 leaders who recently met in Toronto to fulfill their commitment to alleviate poverty in the developing world. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The fate of Zimbabwe's lucrative diamond industry is uncertain. The embattled Southern African country is still waiting to receive approval to export diamonds from the Kimberley process, the system established to stop conflict diamonds from entering the market, endorsed by the diamond industry and non-governmental watchdogs. Human rights groups have lobbied heavily against allowing Zimbabwe to export its diamonds since mines were seized by the military loyal to President Robert Mugabe. A recent meeting of the Kimberley process in Tel Aviv ended in a deadlock. Most African countries, including South Africa and Botswana, supported allowing Zimbabwe to export its diamonds, which could produce over $1 billion a year in revenue. The United States, Canada, Australia, and human rights groups remain opposed to certifying Zimbabwe's diamond mines as long as they remain under military control, with accusations of massive corruption, torture, and beatings. The Kimberley process hired a monitor, Abby Klikane, a South African businessman, to investigate the situation in Zimbabwe. His report concluded Zimbabwe had met the minimum standards and the country should be allowed to export its diamonds. While Klikane was in Zimbabwe, government intelligence agents raided the office of a top civil society group, the Center for Research and Development. According to Human Rights Watch, the group's leader, Farai Maguwu, was arrested 2 days after he met with Klikane and discussed confidential information on the military presence in diamond mines. The one-year suspension of the Muslim Student Union at the University of California at Irvine has raised questions of double standards concerning student protests against public figures. The university sanctioned the Muslim group for planning and orchestrating the disruption of a speech by Israeli Ambassador Michael Oren at the Irvine campus in conservative Orange County, California. According to the Los Angeles Times, supporters of the Muslim group say the university succumbed to pressure from the local Jewish community, which was aware of the plan to disrupt the speech. Reem Salahi, an attorney for the Muslim group, noted students disrupted the speech of former Bush administration official John Yoo in 2005. Police escorted student hecklers outside, but no arrests were made. Yoo had written controversial memos justifying torture of terrorism suspects for the Bush administration. In addition, there have been major protests this year against university fee increases that led to the arrest of student activists and disciplinary reviews. However, no other student organization faces suspension due to protests. Administrators at UC Irvine say the Muslim Student Union case is different, claiming the student group actively planned in advance to disrupt the speech. The university had gathered evidence, including emails and the group's meeting minutes, and warned students against disrupting Ambassador Oren's speech. The Obama administration has quietly used its powers to expand the rights of gay and lesbian Americans. Individually, these orders have received little media attention in comparison to often heated congressional battles over the federal hate crimes law and the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell ban on homosexuals serving in the military. A few of Obama's actions include allowing gay partners of federal employees to buy long-term health insurance and receiving access to daycare and other benefits. The Census Bureau says it plans to report on the number of people declaring they live in a same-sex relationship. In addition, hospitals must now allow gays to visit sick partners. The Christian right has paid close attention to Obama's incremental steps in advancing gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender, or GLBT, rights. Focus on the Family recently criticized Obama's Father's Day proclamation for embracing two-father families, along with single fathers, stepfathers, and guardians. Despite these progressive steps, the Obama administration faces intense pressure from the gay community to end the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the military and move towards repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act, signed into law by former President Bill Clinton. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
When Afghan war commander General Stanley McChrystal was fired for insults hurled at civilian leaders quoted in a Rolling Stone article, President Obama made the point that he was terminating the man while retaining his counterinsurgency strategy. This shakeup in the Afghan war command comes as the number of U.S.-NATO soldiers killed in June was the highest seen since the start of the war in 2001. The Senate Armed Services Committee voted to approve General Petraeus as the president's choice to succeed General McChrystal as a U.S.-Afghan war commander, with the full Senate expected to quickly confirm him. During the Senate hearing, General Petraeus said he was considering reversing rules of engagement, restricting the use of heavier firepower that were originally implemented to reduce the number of Afghan civilian casualties. While the general said that President Obama's July 2011 deadline for the start of withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan was only the beginning of a process, there is increasing skepticism that U.S. troops would actually start coming home by next summer. Some in Congress are moving to tie future funding for the war with a firm withdrawal date. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst Melvin Goodman, whose recent article is titled "The Pentagon's Threat to the Republic." Here, he expresses concern about the conflicts between America's military and civilian leadership seen in the McChrystal firing, and the larger issue of maintaining civilian control of the Pentagon as the Afghan war continues in an uncertain direction.
Obama took the only action he could take. I can't imagine any other action than to fire McChrystal as the commander in Afghanistan, and today McChrystal announced he was leaving the Army after 30-some years. But given the kind of challenge it represented and the total disdain that McChrystal and his staff had for the civilian leadership of the government, I think this was seen as a challenge to civilian control and leadership as it should have been seen. So I think the firing was correct. The only problem that I think Obama has now created is that in appointing Petraeus and moving Petraeus up to this incredibly high plateau, he has actually enhanced the political power of the military. And this could become an obstacle to the president's exercise of civilian control, I think, in the near term, because Petraeus now will have a great deal of credibility, influence, and power within the administration as someone who will be testifying to Congress on a regular basis. And what Obama has done in firing McChrystal is saying this is a problem with this particular individual. It's not a problem of policy. When really at the heart of all of this is the fact that there is no real policy. Counterinsurgency is not being practiced very effectively. And I can't think of one example in history when a counterinsurgency has been successful when the enemy, in this case the Taliban, enjoyed a sanctuary such as the Taliban does in Pakistan. And then when you look at counterinsurgency campaigns generally, they take on average 13 years, the few that have been successful. Now you could say, well, we've been in Afghanistan since 2001, so that's 9 years, but the fact of the matter is we've only been fighting this counterinsurgency warfare for two. And I don't think the American people have the stomach, or should have the stomach, for another 11 years of fighting against the Taliban. I think it was very interesting to hear Leon Panetta, the CIA director, on national television yesterday, quoting the figure of 50 to 100 as the number of Al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. My own sources tell me that that's even an overstatement, that it's probably a figure that's under 50. So now we have 100,000 troops in Afghanistan looking for 50 Al-Qaeda agents. I mean, the policy is out of control. It's hard to explain or to rationalize. And I think the military, when you look at the Rolling Stone article, which I've read, is also out of control. And this is where you get to some of the culture issues that I wrote about based on my 18 years at the National War College and my 3 years in the U.S. Army.
Mel Goodman, there's some people who thought President Obama should not have fired McChrystal, dismissing some of what was said in the Rolling Stone article as just locker room talk and not to be taken seriously. But you do take it very seriously in terms of the kinds of comments made by General McChrystal about his superiors and civilian control that goes really to the heart of the U.S. Constitution in terms of who really is in charge of the U.S. military. You want to expand on that
a bit? Exactly. It goes back to what the Founding Fathers wanted for the United States. And it goes back to what is one of the most important tasks in political governance, which is to make sure that civilians retain control over the military. So when I picked up the New York Times and saw David Brooks, who minimized McChrystal's remarks as kvetching, and even Maureen Dowd referred to McChrystal and his smart aleck aides as engaging in towel-snapping jocularity, I realized these people don't even understand what's at stake here. The Washington Post's editorial board wanted to keep on McChrystal. I thought he shouldn't be fired, and they quoted Karzai, Afghan President Karzai, as calling McChrystal the best commander of the war, as if Karzai has become some kind of analyst of U.S. military leaders. So they have not taken this seriously, but this is the fundamental issue of civilian supremacy in military policy and decision-making. Now, Obama here has actually been part of the problem, not part of the solution. He has clearly shown signs of being intimidated by the military. In fact, McChrystal even said he thought that Obama was intimidated in his meeting with him that took place after his insubordination in London in October when he was summoned to meet with the president and showed up in his combat fatigues. Well, anyone who's been around the military knows firsthand that that was an act of disrespect right on the face of it. But again, if you go back in the history of this country and why those people who left Europe didn't want to see another anarchic system and why they put so much power, particularly on war, in the hands of the Congress and not in the president, clearly made, though, the president the commander in chief. And I think this is what's being threatened by a military class that has become a professional military class, almost like a Prussian military arrangement, going back to Richard Nixon's abolishing of the draft during Vietnam as a deal with middle-class families who would stop protesting the war once they knew their children wouldn't be drafted into this war. None of this is good for the country. The only thing that would be good for the country is if this led to a real debate on the war and the futility of the war. So it's time to get serious about this drain on our resources, our loss of life, our loss of influence around the world, the weakening of the American position internationally, the weakening of the American position at home because we can't afford to do the things we need to do because we have a $700 billion defense budget that will continue to grow and grow. And that budget now is sacrosanct as we look for cuts in all other areas of government. Somehow the defense budget has been given some special standing. So it's all quite alarming to me.
That was former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is titled Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Against a backdrop of growing international condemnation of Israel for its violent repression of both Palestinians and their supporters, most Israelis have rallied behind their government. The vast majority of Israelis supported both the invasion of Gaza 18 months ago and accepted their government's explanation of why 9 Turkish activists were killed by Israeli soldiers aboard the Gaza Freedom Flotilla on May 31st as they tried to break Israel's blockade of Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his government is only trying to stop rockets from being fired from Hamas-controlled Gaza aimed at nearby Israeli towns. But Israeli control of the land, sea, and airspace around Gaza, as well as its 43-year occupation of the West Bank, have repeatedly been condemned by the United Nations as violations of international law. A small group of Israeli activists have launched a campaign called Boycott From Within, working in solidarity with the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS campaign, launched several years ago by a broad cross-section of Palestinian non-governmental organizations. It's a nonviolent campaign whose goal is to force Israel to withdraw from occupied Palestinian territories. Israeli activist Ofer Naiman is one of the leaders of the Boycott From Within campaign. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Naiman by phone in Jerusalem, where he talked about his group's efforts to raise awareness of the BDS campaign within Israel, how the campaign is perceived in the country, and what impact it's having.
There are Israelis, not just a few, who think that this is equivalent to treason. I disagree. I mean, first of all, I mean, it's a non-violent campaign. It's very important to emphasize this. On the left, I mean, people are less likely to call us traitors, but there are quite a few Israeli peace activists who have problems with this initiative because, in a sense, it means that you're giving up on Israeli society to some extent. But I do think that more and more Israeli peace activists are now coming to terms with this initiative and accepting it. More and more people on the left are supporting it, and I see it as something that will continue to happen because, I mean, when people see that it's the only alternative, that it's the only thing that can work, we'll have more and more support. Israel has been imposing much more strict measures of boycott and sanctions on the Palestinian population. I mean, ours is not a violent campaign. I mean, Israel's blockade is a violent campaign of sanctions. And another thing about BDS is that, you know, it gives a voice to people all over the world. I mean, someone living in the States can join this initiative and can be active. I think it's very important because many people all over the world, especially American citizens who are simply fed up with American policies, including Obama's policies in the Middle East, now they can do something. I mean, there is a global campaign, and people can join this campaign.
You know, boycotting goods, especially those made by Israel in the occupied West Bank, isn't nearly as controversial as the academic sanctions part of your work. And you've said that it's not aimed at individual academics or, you know, at stopping publication of their work, but that it's more systemic. Can you give some examples? What do you mean by that?
Tel Aviv University, they have a center for strategic studies inside the university, and they have all kinds of academics and experts or so-called experts issuing policy papers. And some of these policy papers include recommendations to commit acts which, from our point of view here, are war crimes or oppressive or violations of human rights. Haifa's University, they have a special program for IDF officers, which makes it easier for IDF officers to obtain their academic degree. These are just a few examples of cooperation between Israeli universities and the Israeli military establishment.
Ofer Neiman, critics of BDS charge there should be more, not less, cultural cross-pollination in order to keep Israel from becoming more and more captive to the most right-wing ideologies. But the cultural boycott seems to be really taking off, with several international celebrities canceling concerts in Israel in the past few months. Your comments?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a snowball effect. I mean, because more and more artists are canceling, and then there's a picket line. And in that case, it's more difficult for other artists to cross that picket line. So recently, we've had some cancellations by Carlos Santana, by the Pixies, Devendra Banhart, Gil Scott-Heron would be another example, the guy who wrote the song The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. So we're seeing more cancellations. Sometimes people are not very explicit about it. They just say that they have to cancel for security reasons. But, I mean, the real reasons are quite obvious. Some people have said explicit things about that. One should also mention Elvis Costello. He wrote a very nice message about it. He put it on his website. And right now, I mean, more and more artists are seeing what happens when artists do come to Israel. It's very likely that they will perform to a crowd waving Israeli flags. And that means that when they come to Israel, they take sides. So, I mean, there's a picket line, and someone crossing that line is making a statement. Obviously, many artists are reluctant to do that. I mean, they prefer to stay at home and refrain from performing in Israel.
Can you clarify the goals of the BDS campaign, including the work from inside Israel?
The campaign's focus is on the occupation, but at least the Palestinian call for academic and cultural sanctions. They're also talking about other important issues like the refugee problem and the treatment of Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. I mean, none of these calls is trying to impose a certain solution, you know, a one-state solution or a two-state solution, but it's just important to clarify that it's not only about the occupation. This campaign is a consequence of Israeli policies, because I mean, if Israel had accepted the Saudi initiative, which is not just a Saudi initiative, it's an initiative by the Arab League, a comprehensive peace initiative based on the two-state solution and the 67 borders, then there would be no BDS campaign.
That was Ofer Nyman of the Boycott From Within campaign. For more information, visit the group's website at boycottisrael.info. Much like at many other summit meetings of heads of state of the world's wealthiest countries, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets to express their opposition to the policies of the Group of Eight, or G8 and G20 nations, during their late June gatherings in Huntsville and Toronto, Canada. Activists from many nations marched and rallied on a number of issues, including rising unemployment, indigenous rights, global warming, and alleviating worldwide poverty. Canada spent nearly $1 billion on security and deployed 19,000 police for the summit meetings. While the vast majority of those demonstrating engaged in peaceful protest, a small faction of Black Bloc anarchists smashed windows of downtown storefronts and burned several police cars. The property destruction provoked a delayed, indiscriminate police crackdown where nearly 600 people were arrested, including bystanders and journalists, and raids were conducted on nearby college campuses. The Jubilee Network, one of the groups concerned about the discussions in Toronto, charged that there has been a lack of follow-through on pledges made by the G20 to alleviate poverty in the world's developing nations. Just before the summit began, the group released a critical report titled Making the Grade, the G20's Commitments to the World's Poorest. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Haley Hathaway, communications coordinator with the Jubilee USA Network, who discusses the failure of G20 leaders to effectively address global social justice issues.
I think the large-scale protests really shows how deeply affected people around the world are by the economic crisis that is happening as we speak. And the G20 was meeting in Toronto. This is the group of the 20 countries with the greatest gross national products, meeting in Toronto to discuss what they were saying was the international economic system, how they're going to confront this global economic crisis. And what I think people were protesting is that they didn't feel that their voices were heard. We didn't feel that our voices were heard. You have a group of finance ministers meeting with little accountability and little true representation of what the economic crisis feels like on the ground. So that's why Jubilee is bringing the message of the G20's commitments to the world's poorest. We're trying to lift up the voices from the Global South who don't have a seat at the table in the G20.
I know your group just issued a report titled Making the Grade, the G20's Commitment to the World's Poorest, which is quite critical of the course that these nations are on with regard to addressing the issues of global poverty. Tell us a bit about that report. What did you find?
We started off by analyzing both what the G20 had committed to when they met in April last year and what they have followed through since then and what they still need to do in order to really address the crisis felt by our brothers and sisters in the Global South. And we actually gave them a D grade for breaking a lot of the promises. They started in April with a more or less solid commitment to both analyzing the impacts and taking responsibility for the impacts of the economic crisis, but also providing aid, reducing debt burdens for the low-income countries. And since then, there's been little progress. Right after the meeting last April, they gave a little bit of money and seemed like they were moving forward, but since their second meeting in September, really nothing has happened. So we were calling on them, hoping to have them use the moment this weekend when they were meeting to really be bold in following through on their commitments and then going farther.
From what we know now of what occurred at the Toronto G20 summit, was there any progress made? Was there any movement made on following through on commitments made earlier to help the world's poorest?
There were were a few. The G20 reiterated their commitment to the Millennium Development Goals, which are the goals established in 2000 to have poverty by 2015. And we found, and a lot of groups have found, that that we're not very close in many ways to reaching these goals by 2015. So the G20 reasserted that this was something that they were interested in. At the same time, they didn't commit to more money or even mention the fact that last April they committed to $50 billion for the lowest income countries. They also established a development working group that would be looking at some of these issues and bringing it to their next meeting, which is in Seoul, Korea, in November. So we'll see what comes out of that. I think what we need to do is keep on pushing them to take action, to follow through on these very real and concrete commitments that they seem like they're trying to forget from last year.
Now, some of the other issues that Jubilee and other coalition members are concerned about have to do with global warming, the debt crisis, and reforming the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which have long been targets of groups concerned about global inequality. Mm-hmm. What can you say has happened or not on those issues at the Toronto Summit?
Well, the G20 did talk about global warming. They made a kind of broad commitments to combating climate change. However, they talked about it in a way that would make one assume that these commitments that they're talking about are going to be non-binding and country-specific. So countries can decide what they want to do to combat climate change and don't have to do it if they don't want. So something that we see in our work is the devastating impact of climate change already on people in the poorest countries. Jubilee takes it from an interesting standpoint. This is where we really listen to our partners worldwide, where in terms of climate change, we ask the question of who owes whom. So a lot of countries are taking out new loans in order to combat climate change, and even though it's countries like the United States and industrialized countries that have made the most severe impact on the environment. So we reiterate this phrase, who owes whom, and saying, is it just that countries in Africa and in Asia, the small island countries, have to take on even more debt for a crisis they didn't cause?
That was Haley Hathaway, communications coordinator with the Jubilee USA Network. Visit their website at jubileeusa.org to download a copy of the group's Making the Grade G20 report. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.